Afternoon, everyone. I hope you can hear me okay. Yes? Good. I'm going to get started pretty quickly. I have kind of a lot to talk about. I have a few slides at the beginning and a few slides at the end, but I'd like to spend most of this time kind of in Visual Studio writing some C# code. Before I get started, a couple of questions for you guys. How many of you are using VS 2015 and C# 6 features? Okay, most people are using C# 6. I'll touch briefly on those. We'll spend most of the time on stuff that we're working on for C# 7, and then I'll end with a few quick words on some of the directions that we're thinking about for C# 8 and what might be coming later. So before that, a little bit of background, kind of less about the language, but I don't know how many people have felt that maybe C# is aging or is not out there. There's some evidence from Stack Overflow's survey recently that C# is up here, kind of fourth most popular language according to Stack Overflow questions. Also, the most loved languages has C# down here at number 9, so that's pretty good out of all the languages. Another language that I actually work on is up here at number 3, F#, so that's another kind of Microsoft language that works on .NET. My team also makes F# as well. So just C# and F#, they're kind of pushing along, moving language design forward, and they're kind of great languages that have a lot of momentum, and we're trying to keep it that way. In doing that, there's kind of a bit of a balancing act, right? We want to improve the languages, but one of the things that makes C# great is that it's a fairly simple language. So we have to decide, kind of, there's always a tension between those two things. There's, you know, things where we could try to be attractive to new users who've never used C# before, and maybe they're missing features that they have from their other favorite language that they're coming from. Or we can take a look at the pain points that our existing C# customers have and try to make them easier. And so we're always kind of trying to walk this tightrope and kind of balance between these different things. Then the last one, which I'll talk about with some examples later on, is kind of, we want to embrace new paradigms. You saw that kind of with Link and C# 3, this whole kind of functional style that we started going after. But we want to do that in a way that feels natural to C# users. And so we spend a lot of time looking at features that exist in other languages and then thinking, well, how would we make that feel at home in C#? And like I said, I have a couple of examples of that later on. The larger .NET picture, there have been some talks I saw on the schedule this morning and this afternoon, but it's really been a kind of an interesting few years to work in the .NET space at Microsoft and see kind of the change in what we've been doing. We've been kind of changing our tune as we go from running only on Windows to running everywhere. With .NET Core and with Xamarin, kind of C# now targets more computers than just about any other programming language except maybe Java and C. So it's way up there in terms of the number of machines that you can run .NET code on. You know, traditionally .NET has been a system component that you kind of got with Windows. It was a pain to install it. With .NET Core, we're moving to being able to deploy that runtime directly with your app. Along the same front, we've gone from running in a virtual machine, not like a Parallels virtual machine, but the common language runtime virtual machine, to having direct to native compilation, right? So that started with kind of our UWP tools. It's something that Xamarin has done for iOS and Android as well. It's something that we're looking at bringing to more and more platforms as we start looking at containerization of microservices and Docker with .NET. One of the things that we want to do is be able to pre-compile those apps to native so that they have kind of the minimum startup time and the minimum memory footprint, and so trying to leverage some of that native compilation technology. Moving in more to kind of what I work on directly, we've gone from black box compilers that had that kind of took source code in at one end and gave you an assembly at the other end, to having APIs that, tool authors can use to provide rich language understanding. I talked a little bit about that last night, kind of how you can do that. Tomorrow, I'm giving a talk on Visual Studio 15 and some of the stuff that we've built using those APIs. We're also using that to make it so that you can edit not just in Visual Studio, but also in the editor of your choice. We're now project maintainers and active contributors to the OmniSharp project on GitHub, which is a little language server protocol that answers REST queries like, what should be in the completion list at this position in a file? Or what are the errors in this project? And that's consumed by editors like VS Code, MacVim, Atom, Sublime Text. There's plugins for a whole bunch of different editors that can kind of get rich information that's, again, built using this open compiler API, but we want to really enable you to use the editor of your choice. And finally, we've been moving from this kind of proprietary world to an open source world. Specifically, all of .NET Core is open source on GitHub. All of the compilers and the Visual Studio integration and all that stuff is open source on GitHub. That's where we do all of our language design discussions. We post the design meeting notes there. People are welcome to give us their opinions on what they want, where they want to see C# go. I encourage you to check out http://roslyn.io, which is a redirect to our GitHub page for the languages and compilers. So, with that said, let's talk about what C# is, what Roslyn is. It's really the idea is that it's the C# language engine. There should only be one set of people who have to know all of the details of how overload resolution works. And we should make that available as a library, as an API, that other people can take advantage of to build the tools that they want. Egg can power, like I said, IDEs and editors, static analysis tools, fixes and refactoring, source code generation, scripting, read eval print loops. Oh, and it does compiling on the side too. But there's a lot more to it than just that. So that's kind of the intro material that I wanted to talk about. Now I'm going to flip over and spend most of the rest of the time in Visual Studio. So let's start. I said REPLs. How many of you know that there is a C# REPL that's in Visual Studio? One, two, great. Okay, so this is actually something that shipped in VS 2015 update 1. We made it really, really easy to discover. If I go up here to the edit or to the view menu, and then I come all the way down here to other menus, and then I come all the way down here to the bottom, there's this menu item for C# Interactive. And so I can open that and I get this little window inside Visual Studio and it says I can type pound help for help. I'm going to ignore that for a second and just type some C# code. So here's some very simple C# code. I can type an expression like 2 plus 2. And what does that do? It tells me that it's 4. So I just typed a C# expression and it evaluated it. That's not really that interesting, but let's take a look at something else that I can do. So I can declare a variable. So let's say, sorry, my typing is not very good today. I'll use one of those C# 6 features that I talked about, not yet. Let's just say, so I can declare a variable, put a semicolon on it, that makes it a statement, that means I don't get to see what the output value is, but I can type that variable name and just ask the REPL, hey, what's the value of that variable? So that's pretty simple stuff. Let's have another variable for kind of where we are. So let's call it where, and we'll say we're at .NET conf UI. Then I can use C# 6 features like string interpolation, for example. So I can put a dollar sign before my string, type a string, put braces in the string, and that gives me a little hole where I can then just type regular C# code. So something like the variable that I just did. and then we can evaluate that, and it gets compiled down into a two-string call, and you can see kind of exactly what the value is there. But you can do more than just expressions and statements in the REPL. You can kind of explore building up larger things. So maybe I want to have a method that I declare. So let's do along the same thing, theme of greeting. Let's just say greet people. And then I can just keep typing in here a method. And so what do I want to do in this method? Let's say that I want to console.writeline. Hello. From, make this an interpolated string too, just for fun. And so now I've declared that function, and I can just go ahead and call it. And you can see that it kind of works. You'll notice I accessed this variable where here from inside it. We support capture kind of the way that you would if you were declaring a lambda inside a method or anything like that. I can, in fact, redefine this method. So maybe I want to make it a little bit simpler using another C# 6 feature. I can go ahead and do an expression-bodied method. And you'll see, I don't know if you can see on that screen, but this console is kind of faded out a little bit. That's because I actually have a using static for system.console, so I can get rid of that too. And I can kind of make it nice and brief. And so let's actually change that just to show that we kind of redid the definition. So we'll say hello again from there. And if I invoke this function again, we should get the new one. So that's kind of simple stuff, but it's just kind of great to try out a new library that you might be using. You can use /r, for example, to reference a DLL that you might be using to pull it into scope. And so this is kind of just a great way to play with APIs and see what they might look like while you're doing. I don't know how many people are like me and have console application 212 somewhere on their machine just from creating little console applications to try some bit of code. So this is a great way to not have to do that anymore. That's pretty much all I wanted to show for C# 6 stuff. There's a few more features, but since most of you are already using it, I was going to kind of flip into C# 7 and spend most of the rest of this time writing a very simple program. So starting here, have an empty program. First thing we're going to do is we're going to get some numbers. So we'll make an array of numbers. And we want these to be kind of powers of two binary numbers. One thing you've never been able to do in C# until now is write a binary literal. You can do hex literals, and you can do decimal literals. But we decided that it was finally time to add binary literals. So I can do 0b10, 0b100, and I can't do a 2 because that's obviously not a binary number, but I can do 1,000. And then binary numbers start to get big pretty quickly, so we allow you to put separators in there. So you can put an underscore, and then more numbers. So these underscores, we don't really validate where you put them or anything like that. We leave that up to you. And so you can put them kind of in the middle. You can put as many as you want. We don't treat them. We just basically, when we're looking at a number, we ignore them. You can put them in hex literals and decimal literals and all those things. But if you have large constants that you're doing, you can use underbars to make them easier to read. All right, so that's C# 7. Those are two of the probably the least interesting features in C# 7. But they're just little things that we wanted to kind of throw in there to make your lives a little bit easier. So now I've got this array of numbers. What do I want to do with it? I want to tally these numbers. So let's write a method to do that. And what do I mean by tallying the numbers? We'll just go ahead and ask the IDE to generate this. What I mean by tallying is I want to find out the sum of all of the numbers and the count of how many numbers that I dealt with. So I have this method that the IDE generated for me. I'm going to get rid of the private keyword just because I don't like to look at it. But now I have to pick a return type. So what do I want to return? Do I want to return the sum or the count? Well, really, I want to return both. And so in C# 7, I can actually do that. So I can just say, I'd like to return a pair of ints. So these are called tuples. This is a two-tuple. You can have three tuples, four tuples, five tuples, etc. And it's really a great way of packaging up multiple values together. And so now I have a tuple type as the return type of this method. I can come up here, and I can go ahead and consume that. So what does it look like to consume that? What do I get after I type tdot? Well, I have these wonderful fields, item 1 and item 2. So I can go ahead and reference item 1 and count. Well, we put that one second, so let's use that as item 2. So this is great. I can return two values at the same time. There's one kind of problem to it, which is these are both ints. It's pretty confusing. Which one is the sum and which one is the count? Well, we allow you to optionally specify names here. And if you specify names, those are flowed through all of the tooling to help you out. But it doesn't actually make a different type. It stays the same type underneath. If I come up here and look at completion again, you can see that I still have item 1 and item 2. Those are not errors, but I also have sum and count. And those are just kind of aliases to those same fields. We're thinking about probably hiding item 1 and item 2 if there are real names so that it's not confusing. But in general, you can go ahead and use kind of the nice names that make it easy to remember what's going on. So that's kind of consuming literals as, or consuming tuples as tuples. But for those of you who have a functional programming background, this is not often the way that people consume tuples. Usually what you want to do is you want to split that tuple apart into its constituent parts, what we call deconstructing it. And so we support that as well. So I had a tuple type syntax in the return type, I can have a tuple declaration here. And so I can just say sum count equals those. And that gives me two locals. One is called sum, one is called count. And those are the two parts of that tuple field. So I can split it back apart. In fact, it goes a lot further than that. We built a general mechanism for deconstructing types into different values. So basically, if the compiler can find a method called deconstruct that matches a certain pattern, then you can split a type apart into its constituent pieces using this kind of assignment or declaration for any type. And that can be an instance method that's on the type, or you can declare an extension method to do it if you wanted to as well. So you could say, split apart key value pairs if you're iterating over a dictionary or whatever type you want, you can kind of deconstruct it in this kind of statement. All right, so that's kind of consuming the tuples. Let's look at using them. What does it look like in here? Let's go ahead and actually implement this method. So we'll implement it in the simplest possible way that's not actually right. But just like I have tuple types where I can have multiple values in parentheses, or multiple types and optionally names in parentheses, I can specify multiple values in parentheses, and we call that a tuple literal. And so in this case, I'm returning a pair of values, 0, 0. We don't actually want to do that, because we need to do a little bit more. So let's introduce a local for this guy, and we'll call it result. Now we'll just call it R so I don't have to type as much. So we'll start with R. Again, this is just a pair of unnamed things. You can see I can hover over R here, and it tells me that it's a local variable of type int, comma, int, named R. I'm going to forget which one of those is the sum and which one of them is the count. And so I'm going to have a way to specify names here. So I'm going to use S and C. So going back to something that I mentioned earlier in the slides, where I was talking about kind of fitting things into the way that C-sharp feels, you'll notice that up here in tuple types, I have kind of type name, variable name, and down here I have name colon and tuple values. I have name colon value. So why are those different? Why do we choose those? Well, the idea is that this is part of a signature, and so the set of return types should look similar to the set of parameter types. And so there's kind of this consistency between here's what my return types and their parameters and names are, and here's what my incoming types and names are. Similarly, down here in the tuple literal, this looks like calling a method where I'm using named arguments that we added in C-sharp 4. So I can do name colon value. And so this is kind of helping take a feature that exists in tons of other languages, Python, F-sharp, Haskell, tuples are kind of in all of those languages, and figuring out how it fits naturally into C-sharp. And so these are a couple of examples. Okay, that's a lot of time to write not a lot of code. So let's get to the meat of this problem. Let's go ahead and add these things up. So let's for each over these numbers, and what are we going to do in that? We're going to say R equals a new tuple literal with sum is R dot sum, and count is R dot count plus 1. All right, so this is a perfectly fine way of typing that tuple literal. I make a new tuple that has the values incremented by 1, and we kind of go on from there. You might wonder, well, what's the cost of doing this? I'm making a new tuple every time through this loop. Aren't I, you know, using up a bunch of allocations, possibly making my program slow down? Well, you don't have to worry about that. The tuples that we use under the covers, they're all backed by value types. And so anytime they're used as a local or as a return like this, they're going to be stack allocated values. And so they won't pay any garbage collection cost. Similarly, because they're stack allocated values, we can actually go and just change the fields directly. We made them mutable fields. And I don't know how many of you feel okay with that. But we feel okay with it. And the reason why is precisely because they are kind of this stack allocated object. And so anytime you pass it to somebody else, they get a copy of it, and they can't modify your copy of it. And so we made it convenient for you to change it kind of locally, but because other people get a copy, they don't get to change yours. So C++, there we go. So that's another way of kind of writing this loop. I can just kind of change it in place, and I don't have to worry about I don't have to worry about allocating new ones. The cost of these should be basically the same as if I declared my own struct that had these two things. But the other thing that's kind of nice about it is I don't have to declare my own struct. And so we go ahead and do all the things that you would want to happen on your struct. So we override equality and get hash code and all of those things so that these tuple types behave the way you want them to behave. So you can use them as the keys to dictionaries, you can use them as values in dictionaries, all of those things work the way you want them to be, as efficiently as we know how to generate them without you having to write out a whole bunch of boilerplate code to get a good hash code and equals and all of those things. So that's kind of using tuples. This is a pretty simple little program still. Let's make it a little bit more complicated. Let's change this array of numbers to support nested arrays of numbers. And I'm going to do that in kind of a cheating way. I'm not going to declare a new type or anything. I'm just going to make it an object array, And then just to show you what I mean by that, we'll make this value a new object array with these ones. So now the elements of this list can be either numbers or arrays of numbers, or just to make it a little bit more complicated, we'll also allow nulls in there. So now I've got this kind of more complicated list. Let's go ahead, our tally method doesn't take that. So let's go ahead and change this. We'll rename it to values instead of numbers. And then we want this to take that object array instead. Okay, so now we have things looking mostly the way we want them to, except now I can't add v here because v is an object. So how do you guys deal with this normally today? You write an is test, right? So you say if v is int, okay, well now we know, I don't need this. Now we know, no, I do need that. Now we know that it's an int, and so we're all good. But the compiler is still complaining, because even though we just checked that it's an int, we have to tell it again down here that it's still an int. So we have to cast it down here. And now it's happy, but that's kind of a pain to have to do. So what can we do instead? Well, here's another place where we've taken something and we've tried to fit it into an existing part of the language. And so right now we have this idea of an is expression that gives you a Boolean result, whether something is true or not. And what we've done is we've taken that as the first place to introduce to C-sharp something called pattern matching. And the basic idea of pattern matching is that you do two things at once. You both test something and get a Boolean result, and if that test is successful, you extract some sort of result out of it. And so the way that we've modified that for the is expression in C-sharp is that you can now provide another name after the is expression, and if it's true, then I is now an integer with the value. We've done the cast for you, so you don't have to write that anymore. So that's kind of another place where we put patterns in, or where we fit with existing C-sharp functionality. This is kind of one simple type of pattern. This is the one simple type of pattern that we're adding in C-sharp 7. We have a lot of ideas for where we want to go with patterns further on down the road. I can show you some slides later on of some of the ideas where we're going. But this simple kind of type testing pattern is the first one that we looked at. Okay, so now we've handled the case where it's an I. I can go ahead and start handling the other cases where V is an object array and so on. But when I have a bunch of different things that I want to compare with values, there's kind of a more natural language construct in C-sharp to do that. Usually, it's called the switch statement. And so one of the things you can do now is you can now switch on any type of variable, doesn't matter what it is, and we can go ahead and we'll just get rid of this and match against patterns. So I can say case int, oh, completion stomps on me a bit there. I can say case int I and break, fix my formatting. And so now I've got a type pattern within this switch statement where I extract the value out of it. So let's go ahead and do the same thing for object arrays. So case object array, and we'll call it L for list, continuing my pattern of picking one-letter names. And how am I going to implement that? Well, we'll make a nested call, recursive call to tally on L. And then we will do r.s plus equals n.sum and r.c plus equals n.c.count, right? So now I have a type switch, right? I can take an object, I can test it a bunch of different types, and I can do different things on all of those different types. One of the things you'll see as we get through this is that switch statements, we haven't changed them that much, just a little bit. They're a language design construct that's starting to feel a little bit long in the tooth. C-sharp switches look pretty much unchanged from the way C switches looked 50 years ago or so. You need break statements, they're long and verbose, and they're statements, you don't get a value out of them. And so we're kind of toying with the idea of what a modern match expression might look like. It's probably not, let me say that more strongly, it's not coming in C-sharp 7, but it's something that we're still kind of thinking about for C-sharp 8. But anyway, we're not done handling the inputs that we have here. So let's say that performance, for performance reasons, because this is a highly tuned application here, I wanted to make sure that we didn't make this recursive call into tally if the list was empty. Well, I can go ahead and add another case for an object array called L when L.length equals 0. So, and in that case, I just want a break. Don't want to do anything. So the second thing that we've added here is case conditions. So once you've extracted some pattern into L, you can add a further test onto it to figure out whether or not you really want to hit that case statement or not. And one of the things that this means is that unlike ever before in C sharp, multiple case statements can overlap. And so we now have to specify the order of evaluation of testing all of those cases. It's the way you would expect it to. So we go through the cases from the top to the bottom, and the first one that matches, that's the one that we'll enter. So that's why I went ahead and put this one above the one below it, because otherwise it would always happen. It would always take this case below. Finally, you know, this is not really all that exciting, but there's a null pattern too, so I can match against null, and we'll do the same thing there. When I get null, I don't want to recurse or do anything. And so now I've implemented this tally method. It's got patterns, it's got tuples. And there's one other thing that I wanted to show here, which is in two places I do this kind of math on the S and C fields of R. And I'm worried that I didn't get it right in all of those places. So I'm going to make a little helper method. And I'm going to do that right here inside of this method. And so let's have a variable called sum and a variable called count. And in here, I will just do that r.s plus equals sum, r.c plus equals count. And here, I can just change this into add i1. And down here, I can change it into add n.sum, n.count. So here I have a local function. And so this is just a function that's declared inside of another function just to kind of help me out a little bit, keep some logic a little bit separated. One thing you'll notice is that I'm accessing R inside of that method. I do that so we automatically kind of capture variables the same way I showed in the interactive window. We'll capture it for you. Today you can do something kind of like this by defining a lambda and assigning it into an action and then invoking the action. It turns out that doing that involves like 5 or 6 allocations of delegate objects and closure classes and a bunch of stuff. And in the local functions case, we can optimize that a lot more to avoid kind of any of those intermediate allocations. So now I've gone ahead and made a local function to help me out with this. Trying to think what else I wanted to show in here. I think that's most of the language features that I wanted to show. I did miss one thing to talk about tuples. When I was talking about tuples, one of the places that tuples is really, really helpful, that things are really, really painful today, is if I have an async method and I want to return multiple values from it. If I have a non-async method, it's not too terrible. It's a little bit ugly. I have to go and make make out parameters and pass them as out parameters, and I have to break it into a statement context. But I can get around that. But with async methods, we don't allow you to use out parameters at all, and so you're kind of stuck if you have an async method. But the nice thing about tuple types is that they are just types. And so I could make this, tally async, and just have that tuple type right there. I could await task.delay. And up here, I can go ahead and just say await, and it's going to complain because this isn't an async method. But kind of tuples flow through async. They flow through the type system kind of just the way that you would want them to. So they're kind of generally useful, like I said, for mixing together a pair of values to put into a dictionary with names as the key, or as just a set of values instead of making specific types for all of those things. So I think that's what I wanted to show you of C# 7. I have some slides for a few more features that I didn't fit into this demo. I can do one of them here in code instead of in a demo. So let's do that one. So one more simple thing that's kind of nice is, how many of you have used a method like int.tryParse that does take those out parameters before? So let's say that I'm doing int.tryParse and I want to pass out, oh shoot, now I'm here. I have to go back to the line above and I have to declare some int value, and I can't give it var because I don't know, because I'm not going to assign a value into it, and it's kind of generally a pain. Well, now you can. Just go ahead and say out var I here, and then I can go ahead and use I later on. So this is, again, just like a tiny little thing. But it means that I kind of can kind of stay in this expression context of a method call and declare my variable directly in line there and then just continue to use it afterwards. And kind of our existing flow analysis and definite assignment rules tend to work out pretty well, so that you can't end up using var if it's not gonna have been called, and the scoping rules work out great, so you can just go ahead and use I where you would want it use I. So that's kind of another very simple little thing that we've put in there. All right, let me flip back over to slides and see what I've got. So what do we recap in C# 6? Expression body members, string interpolation. Oh, I didn't even get to the fun ones. Conditional access operator. We have the question mark dot operator in C# 6 that kind of tests the left-hand side and skips the right-hand side. I don't know how many of you have started using that in programs to avoid null checks, but it's really kind of handy. So the conditional access operator is great. Name of, I talked about it a lot last night for people that were here, but it's just kind of a great refactoring safe way of naming program elements in your code so that if I want to rename them later on, they get updated appropriately. I've been using this idea of using static throughout my demos, so I have up here using static system.console. That's why I can just say write line, because then now all the static members of console are just kind of in scope. This is something that we added in C# 6. It's handy for classes like console or math, so I don't have to say math.sine, math.cos, math.squareroot all the time. I can just say sine, cos, square root. Finally, exception filters. We're playing catch up to Visual Basic and F#. They kind of supported this idea of exception filters, and we added them so I can catch exceptions only when some condition is true. And so that's where we got that when keyword for case conditions from, is we kind of used it already in C# 6 for doing exception filters. And we have the interactive window. So what do we do in C# 7? I wanted to say I'm using almost the final build of what will be Visual Studio 15 Preview 5. That is not available today. It's going to be available very soon. So you guys should be paying attention. And pretty soon, you should be able to try out all the stuff that I just did on a preview of VS 15. So we talked, and I showed kind of tuples, patterns, local functions, binary literals, digit separators. I showed outvar as well, even though I had it on my list as something that I have slides for. The other two things that are implemented in this build that I have, but I didn't show, are ref locals and returns, and task-like async methods. Finally, they're not in this build yet, but they've been added since we snapped for the preview 5 build. Two new language features, throw expressions, and more expression-bodied members. So I have, like I said, some slides with examples of what these things kind of look like. And so the first one, ref locals and returns. The idea here is that I can go ahead and put ref on the return type of a method that I, or a property or something that I'm doing. And then the just like ref parameters, that object is not copied back out of that method. Instead, a reference to it is kept. This is useful primarily for people doing some fairly low-level things. So two common examples are 3D graphics programming or network stack implementations. So one of the ideas that you have, like in this example, maybe some big array of objects, and each of those objects is a value type. It's a big struct. Rather than copy that big struct out to give it back to the person that you, to your consumer, you can just give them a reference to it. And then they, it doesn't involve any of the copies. It also means that they can mutate it in place. They can get a mutable reference to it where they can change things directly in your array if you want them to. So this is something that you, most people probably won't run into most of the time. But there are certain applications where you might. I think the Unity guys have been pretty interested in updating some of their APIs to start using ref returns and ref locals. Task-like async methods. The idea here is that just like you can use async today with a task, we kind of stumbled when we did the language design of async because it's one of the few places in the language where we're really strongly tied to a particular type name. Most of the time, we just go look at methods. So for each loops, for example, we just look to see if there's a getEnumerator method. And if there is, we're happy to use it. We don't care whether your type actually implements IEnumerable or not. When it came to async, we stumbled with some of the overload resolution. This time around, we figured it out. And so now you don't have to use the official system.threading.task as the return type of async methods. You just have to have a type that matches a pattern. The reason this is useful is, again, those same allocation type cases. If you have async methods that usually aren't async, that most of the time they return a value right away, right now async can be very expensive because you end up allocating a new task object and potentially a new closure state object and stuff for your type every time you call that method. And so there can be a lot of overhead from using async just from that. And this allows you, the primary motivation of this is it allows you to create a struct-based value task that doesn't incur those allocations on that hot path. Some of our friends in the ASP.NET land rewrote a bunch of their networking stack to do this, and they saw significant performance improvements in kind of those paths, because a lot of those network calls, potentially network calls through something like ASP.NET, they're all async because they might hit the network. But in reality, most of the time you buffer a whole bunch of stuff, and so you have a whole bunch of the next bytes there already, and so the async doesn't actually have to wait for anything, but would still have to allocate a task and go through all of the machinery. So we can kind of lighten up that machinery with this. So it should be mostly a transparent change for anyone using this. It's just you may have async methods that have return types that are not strictly task anymore. They can be kind of anything that has the right getAwaiter method and so on them. All right. Outvar, I showed you an example in code. This is the same example. throw expressions. So right now, throw is a statement. You can only use it in a place where a statement is allowed. You can't use it in a place where an expression is allowed. And we decided that that's dumb. We'd like it to be an expression as well. And so it allows you to do handy little patterns like this one over here. So I can say, well, if the argument coming in is null, then throw an argument null exception, otherwise assign it. It just kind of simplifies some of that boilerplate code that we had. Another one that people have talked about wanting to use it is in the conditional operator, the question mark colon expressions, have one side of those be a throw. So like I said, like trivial, tiny little things, but still handy. The last one was more expression-bodied members. I don't have a slide for this one because it's pretty simple. So the same as you can do those kind of arrow expressions for methods and getter-only properties in C# 6. In C# 7, you can do them for more things. You can do them for operators and constructors and destructors and get and set properties. You can have like get arrow value, set arrow value. So it's just some simpler, lighter syntax for getting at those. C# 8. What are we thinking about for C# 8? These are kind of the four main things that we're thinking about right now as kind of themes. So first of all, we started on trying to help you avoid null reference exceptions with the question dot operator, the conditional access operator. And we think that's a good first step. But we've been watching other languages very closely. As some of you may know, Anders Helsberg, who designed C# originally, he works a lot on TypeScript right now. And so TypeScript just added a bunch of new flow checking based null analysis. Swift similarly has type checking based flow or flow based null analysis. And so we want to take a look at whether we can add something like that into C#. And I have some slides about what that might look like. As I said before, we've only kind of scratched the surface of what patterns look like in pattern matching. We have a bunch of ideas for more patterns that we want to do. Records, avoiding boilerplate code for defining types. So we want to make it easier. And then async streams. This is the one I don't have a slide for, but the idea with async streams is I want to get network data or something asynchronously, and I want to be able to await the next element in that collection. So we don't know the exact syntax will be yet, but maybe it's for each await var x, and that does basically an await between each call, and we introduce a new type called async enumerable that returns a task of an item, and stuff like that is kind of what we're thinking about to make it easier to work with streams of data as you're, you know, talking to services in the cloud, where that data may not come back all in one big chunk. But it was important, like I was saying, to kind of get things like the value task functionality there so that we can handle buffering and chunking and stuff like that well. So async streams is one of the other things that we're thinking about. So let's dive into the first three of these in a little bit more detail, just in slideware. So the ideas that we have so far is just like we allow you to annotate value types as nullable but with the question mark, maybe we'd allow you to start doing that for reference types as well. And so if you put a question mark there, we would say, okay, this person is telling me, the compiler, that maybe this thing can be null. And if you don't put a question mark, then we're going to assume that you mean that should not be null. And so what's kind of the implication of us doing this? Well, it means things like assigning null into n. Sure, that's fine. But what if we could give you a compiler warning if you assign null into something that you didn't put a question mark on? Or, like this third example, if we flow through the fact that n started out as a question mark, and know that you're assigning that question mark into something that says that it's not nullable. And we can go even further. So we can say, well, we won't warn you if you do a dot off of s, because you told us that it's never going to be null because you didn't put a question mark there. But what if we did warn you if you dot directly off of something that you said could be null? And so you could get around that by putting a question mark dot, or like I was saying with kind of flow-based checking, what if we can track the fact that you tested that this thing is not null, and so inside those braces, it's totally fine to use dot on that string, on that variable, because we know it can't be null, because we saw you test it. Right? So this is something that we're kind of prototyping with right now. And we're also thinking about the, even though you think it might be nullable, I promise it's not nullable, really, really exclamation mark bang, as kind of the corollary to the question dot, we'd have the bang dot. So that's kind of our thinking so far. And obviously one of the things that's a challenge here is trying to figure out how to do this in a way that isn't that is backwards compatible. That means you don't compile with our new compiler and suddenly get thousands of warnings about things that could be null. And so that's kind of what we're struggling with right now. We have some ideas, but we have to see how it'll play out. Next up, more patterns. So here's the ones that we have kind of today. What if you could decompose directly in a pattern so that I could extract values, more values out of the patterns? I could extract the properties out. Or I could match one property and test that only if it's exactly 5 does this pattern true, and then I have this y variable that I can use later on. What if I could match a constructor-like syntax instead of a pattern-like syntax? Is there some way to tie together constructor parameters with properties? Last slide, because I know I'm a little bit over. Records. So what do records look like? What if you could write a class like this? And that ended up generating something, all of this kind of boilerplate for equals and get hash code and that deconstruct method that I talked about and the constructors and the properties and all of that stuff. That's kind of what we're thinking about with records. One of the questions that we have is kind of how much can you mix and match and put some pieces from one and some pieces. What if I really like this record exactly as it is, but I want to specify my own equals, but I want everything else to be the way the compiler generated. Is there a way to do that? We're not sure. But those are the kinds of things that we're thinking about. Okay, with that, I'm done. Sorry I went a little bit over. I will stand outside if anybody has any questions. I have some raffle tickets to give away to people who have questions. I have some laptop stickers to give away to people who have questions. You have to ask me a question to get a sticker, though. So thank you, everybody.